I'm Dr. Leif Tapanola from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Our guest today is Melanie Vining. She's executive director for the Idaho Trails Association. Peter, we're talking about trails in Idaho. Have you been on a trail lately?
I think so. I think there's a large portion of Idahoans who've been on trails.
Trails are everywhere.
Yes.
Well, certainly in our neck of the woods. It depends, I guess, on where you live in Idaho, and we'll maybe get into that, of where the distribution of trails are. But
right.
We're lucky here in Pocatello. You just step out the back door, and you're pretty much on a trail.
Yeah.
If you want to be.
And you're ready to go. And, you know, every time we walk on a trail as well, we probably notice the condition of the trail, whether it's good, whether it's poor, or you sit there and you wish there was a trail that went that direction.
Right.
And, you know, I think we're going to talk all about how we use and maintain and build trails in Idaho.
Well, somebody has to do it, right?
Someone has to do it.
Yep. And if you mess it up, somebody has to fix it too.
Someone has to fix it.
We'll dig into that soon. But first, Peter, you got nature in the news.
Yeah. Leif, have you ever wondered how hula hoops defy gravity and continue to stay up around your hip?
I was wondering that earlier this morning.
Yeah.
How did you know?
Because, you know, the other thing that I was wondering is, are there certain body shapes that are better at hula hooping than others?
Well, I would think you have to have defined hips so it has something to catch in order to stay
to
on
catch,
there, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you know, let's look at what the research
what
says.
What does the research? Is this a Hawaiian researcher?
Oh, no. This is out of the New York University.
Oh, okay.
And they decided to tackle these two questions. And how they did this is they created many 3D printed body shapes, such as cylinders, cones, and hourglass to represent the human body.
Sure.
And then they put them on these little tiny motors that had them kind of spin like you would do with a hula hoop.
All right.
And what they found out in all cases, good twirling motion of the hoop is what got that hoop moving.
Good twirling motion.
Yes. Good twirling motion. However, that didn't necessarily relate to how long you can keep that hula hoop spinning.
Go on.
It was the body shape that then ended up and determined how long the hula hoop stayed up. And you're right. An hourglass shape is the best shape for hula hooping. And with what they found is the cone really keeps that hula hoop pushed up with the shape. The cone kind of pushes it up.
Yeah.
But when you have that hourglass shape, kind of that curvy shape, it also acts as a catch to keep that hula hoop in place.
From going too far down
or too far up.
Yep.
And so you needed to have a combination of those two shapes. Of course, the answer is, why on earth would they look at the physics behind hula hooping, right? Well, it's all about for engineers and innovations and, you know, harvesting energy from vibrations and improving robotic processes and positioners, et cetera. So, you know, there is a good scientific need to determine how hula hoops hula.
How hula hoops hula?
Hula, yeah. Yeah.
I'm glad there are people out there doing the hard-nosed science to get us these answers. So an hourglass, and the solution is in how that shape moves.
Yep. And keeps the hula hoop in the proper position. Whereas for me, I'm a cylinder. I can get the hula hoop started, but I will be struggling forevermore on keeping it going.
Well, the big question is, have you ever hula hooped on a trail in Idaho?
You know, the next time I go, I'll have my pack with a foldable hula hoop.
Well, today we're going to be talking about trails in Idaho, and our trivia question for today is on that topic. Roughly how many miles of non-motorized trails are in Idaho? But when we come back from the break, Melanie Vining joins us to talk about trails in Idaho. We'll get the answer to that question and maybe more about Peter's hula hooping tendencies. More after the break. Stay tuned.
This is KISU-FM Pocatello, Idaho Falls, Rexburg. Also available on your Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command play KISU.
Hey, welcome back from the break. Our guest today is Melanie Vining. She's executive director for the Idaho Trails Association. First off, welcome to The Nature of Idaho. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
My name is Melanie Vining. I'm the executive director of Idaho Trails Association. I've been with ITA, as we call it, for about 4 years. Prior to that, I worked actually as a Forest Service hydrologist, so made kind of a big jump from a rather different field to trails, but I had always been interested in trail work as a firefighter in college for the Forest Service. We were looking for early and late season work, and so we would get on with these trail crews and needed an extra hand. And I still remember one of my very first assignments working in the Frank Church Wilderness, actually after the fires of 2000, helping to cut trails open. And it just really stuck with me throughout my career. I loved working outside. And so I'm really happy and excited to have come kind of full circle back to an experience I had 25 years ago now and be working for ITA and out there on the trails every summer.
When did the organization start, the ITA?
ITA was actually founded in 2010. It was a really small group of people in McCall, Idaho, and they got together. I want to say there were maybe 23 people on our first project ever. And 2010, there was only one project. They were kind of a mix of people from conservation groups, retired Forest Service, current Forest Service employees. They kind of got together and said, wow, you know, we see this problem. The Forest Service and other land managers are having a really hard time keeping up with all of the trail maintenance out there, and we'd like to be part of the solution. So formed as a small group of volunteers. I believe they did 6 miles of trail work that first weekend, and that was it for 2010. And the idea was born. We have a picture of that first group gathered at the end of the day, you know, all smiling. And you could just tell from looking at that picture, it was a success. We've grown ever since. Last year, I think in 2024, our total numbers, we maintained about 332 miles of trail through almost 12,000 hours of volunteer time. So just, you know, it's been a relatively short time since ITA was formed, but I think it really speaks to the need and the willingness of people to jump in and help be part of the solution, looking at that growth over 14 years. So really excited to be part of it.
So how did it grow? Were you guys reaching out and contacting landowners, facilities, organizations, or were people saying, oh, wait, there's a trail association and we need help here? So were they contacting you guys, or was it, I'm assuming, a combination of both?
It was a combination of both. You know, I think initially the idea was, let's see how we can partner with a national forest in Idaho. The first one was the Payette National Forest, which, you know, surrounds McCall. And so this group reached out to the Payette National Forest, said, hey, can we go work on this trail? There's, you know, some paperwork involved when you're volunteering for a national forest. They got that done, but it was entirely just sort of funded by people or supported by people showing up with their tools, you know, putting in their own time. And then from there, using that as a template, I think the next year, and I'm not exactly certain how many projects were done in 2011, but that core group of people, and one of them who emerged as ITA's first executive director, Jeff Halligan, who had been a Forest Service packer and worked on trails for many years prior to that, reached out to another forest and said, hey, we're this new volunteer group. Can we come do a project on your forest? And I can only imagine that the answer was, of course you can. You know, the land managers are really awesome and very appreciative of the help and always willing to help us find trail projects to do. So I think that second year, there were a couple of projects. From there, I believe the first grants were applied for, because at some point, you know, you have to buy tools, you have to figure out how to get people to the trailhead, buy all the required safety gear. And the initial outreach, I think, was done through word of mouth, but not long after that, a website was created, ITA volunteers, some of those core volunteers started going to events, you know, outdoor expos, you set up a table, you start talking to people about who you are and what you do. I'm doing outreach through the website, visit and talk with, I think we had some initial events at REI. They have a room, they allow groups to come and do presentations about various things. So we would do presentations about hiking and trail maintenance. And really, it just grew from there. Those first couple of years were pretty key. I want to say the first kind of ITA paid position, which is a good indicator that your group is growing and you're able to secure some funding, was right around 2013. So we've been, you know, just over 10 years with a paid staff member. Now we're a staff of 4. As of this week, we were able to hire a new Northern Idaho Trail Program Specialist as our 4th staff person. So we're pretty excited about that.
Let's talk about trails. So what all is involved? I can imagine all sorts of different kinds of trails for different purposes. As your organization, like, you focus on what kind of trails and what qualifies, I guess, as a trail in this context?
You know, we kind of saw this need for trail maintenance work on hiking trails. And I guess by hiking, non-motorized, primarily equestrians, you know, horseback riders use these trails as well.
These are single track.
Single track, right. So for the most part, we focus on single track, non-motorized trails in Idaho. A lot of that work ends up being in wilderness areas just because we're one group that's able and experienced in going in there to do that work, in addition to like Forest Service trail crews. But that's kind of where our focus area lies.
How does one make a new trail? It's just not something, hey, I'm going to start walking here and eventually get a trail. How do you go about that?
We do help build trails. You know, there are so many miles of existing trails in Idaho that primarily we end up just working on existing trails, maintaining those. But there are kind of two parts, I think, to making a new trail. There's the plan. If it's a Forest Service or BLM, Federal Land Trail, there's environmental analysis that has to happen and environmental clearances and a plan. This is where it's going to be located. This is how steep it needs to be. New trails built by land managers have a different set of standards than trails that we're maintaining out there in, say, the Frank Church Wilderness that might be 100 years old. And they were created purely to get from point A to point B. So if you've ever hiked up one of those trails where you're like, holy cow, my quads are burning, I'm going straight up the hill, that was sort of the style for some of those old trails that would go from, you know, a river bottom to the top of the mountain for a specific purpose. But backing up to building trails, you know, these specifications are kind of mapped out. And then out there on the ground, it really just starts with, you know, if it's outside a wilderness area, there are some pretty cool machines, little narrow tracked machines that will dig that initial, what we call the trail tread, you know, make it flat, cut into the side of the hill. But oftentimes it's still kind of that old fashioned, you know, swinging a shovel or a Pulaski, which is kind of a axe hoe combination, and just digging into the hillside, working as a group. You know, somebody makes that first cut, starts digging into the hillside, and other people follow. And by the end of it, you've got this nice, pretty flat surface. The tread's usually like 18 to 24 inches wide, you know, that nice walking surface. And then you've got your new trail. Sounds like you guys have had a few around Pocatello recently that have been built and provide a little more user-friendly way to get to the top of a hill than the old steep version.
Right. And then we've got trails that need to be maintained because when they get used, they do wear down. You lose that nice flat surface and it is rounded. It turns into a U, and then it's really hard for everyone to use those trails. And so when we step into the maintaining aspect of it, is it similar to building a new trail or?
Yeah, it can be. It really depends on what Mother Nature did over the winter and spring. And like you said, how much use did the trail get? What kind of use? Was it primarily hikers? When did the use occur? The muddy season, I'm sure, in the foothills around Pocatello is very similar to the foothills around Boise. And if you get a ton of use during that really soft kind of runoff season of the spring or after a heavy fall rain, it can really impact that trail. And oftentimes what then happens is people walk around the mud outside of the trail tread because they're slipping or they're, you know, they just want better footing. And then that trail gets wider. And in that case, yeah, going back to do that maintenance, sometimes you're kind of reestablishing that trail tread to bring it back to where you want it, make it, you know, safe to walk on after all that mud is dried and there's maybe, you know, a lot of rutting, trying to pull that soil back in. Yeah, trail maintenance can be heavy. Trail maintenance is what we call it. Lighter trail maintenance might be cutting some of the brush back, cutting a couple trees that have fallen across the trail out so people can pass again. And so it really runs the gamut. But a lot of what we do, especially in the spring, is focused on that trail tread and trying to repair any erosion damage, water just running down that trail. Of course, the steeper the trail is, the more likely it is to have water run right down the middle of it and create ruts that we then have to fill in and fix. So trail maintenance can be very strenuous depending on how the winter went, how Mother Nature treated that trail during runoff season, and just how much use the trail received during that season.
I imagine not only use, but erosion is a big issue, right? You know, maybe an old school approach to making trails is a more direct line going straight up the hill, that sort of thing, which I imagine is more prone to higher rates of erosion on those trails. And that's why maybe switchbacking is kind of more in favor, I guess, of running back and forth. It's probably easier on the legs or mountain bike, whatever it happens to be, but it also cuts down on erosion.
It is, exactly. You know, when a trail goes straight up, especially once it starts to get rutted, it's really hard to get the water off the trail. So ideally, every trail will have drainage features incorporated into the design, whether it's a drain dip where you just dig out some soil and it kind of routes that water off the trail before it can gather much speed and momentum and continue to erode further down the trail. Or, you know, some trails have more engineered structures, whether it's a log installed, or in the backcountry, we use rocks often to really kind of build up something that will last through time and route that water off. But when trails are steep, that's a challenge. If they go, you know, straight up a ridge and they've already been rutted out, you know, if you're a mountain biker, especially, you're just not happy if you're trying to ride your bike up something in a rut and the pedals are hitting the sides. And by that time, by that depth, it can be a real challenge to try to get that trail back to something that's enjoyable to ride or hike. And also somewhat self-maintaining, where if you have a big rainstorm, that water will be routed off via a series of drainage features. Steeper trails on certain soil types too are a lot tougher to maintain, depending on how easily eroded that specific type of soil is.
And that's why, you know, for our listeners, when you're hiking and you see the switchback, don't make that little shortcut. All you're doing is just, you've opened the door for that much more erosion with rainfall and such.
You know, once you start looking for erosion and really looking at a trail through that lens of how is it maintained? How does the water leave the trail? It's kind of like when I learned noxious weed species and then I went out hiking, it's, you never look at things the same again. You see this drainage dip needs cleaning out.
But it also sounds like trail design is important, but there's a lot of behavior of people using the trails that impact the quality and long-term sustainability of a trail, maybe even more than the initial design. And so, you know, I think locally we kind of hear it amongst those of us that use the trails to, you know, be very careful, especially when it's muddy season and runoff season, that those are times maybe you want to certainly behave in a way that's not exaggerating the erosional features, right?
Right. And it's tough. I found myself on trails in the foothills. You get excited to do a trail run. You get there, you drive to the trailhead, you start up the trail and you realize pretty wet, pretty muddy. Yeah. I'm starting to slip, you know, and it takes some discipline to turn around and go back to the car, maybe go find the paved trail or the dirt road to use that day and wait for those to dry out. But it definitely in the long term makes that trail last that much longer and makes it a better experience for people once it dries out.
There are trails everywhere on the landscape. And some of them are well-maintained, let's call them legal trails. And then there are many, many, many trails that are just running through. And sometimes it's actually, as a user, I think a little difficult to tell which one is the right trail and which one might not be like a fully legal sanctioned kind of trail. What are your thoughts on that? How to recognize them? Obviously, we prefer legal trails for a variety of reasons. What's your thoughts there?
Yeah, so I mean, I think there are some areas that are, you know, it's a lot more conducive to what we call user-created trails than others. Obviously, topography is going to control, you know, how many user-created trails are in that steep river country versus maybe out in the sagebrush country. Most of us have the power to kind of hold access to maps right in our hands and know exactly where we are. There are a lot of great resources if you're on BLM ground or Forest Service ground to find the digital version of those maps. And those agencies, and I imagine more local governments, maintain pretty good maps of their trail system. So that's one way to tell if you're on a user-created trail or what the Forest Service will call them system trails. They're legal and part of that map. And, you know, I think one reason to kind of avoid those user-created trails if possible and avoid creating them is that the system trails receive the maintenance. There are funds allocated to that, and volunteer groups like ours or a Forest Service or BLM trail crew, you know, they're out there maintaining those. With the user-created trails, they're not. And if that trail leads across a creek and is eroding sediment into the creek and affecting, say, fish habitat, there's really not a dedicated funding source to go out there and take care of that problem. You know, maybe people don't think about it as much. It can kind of affect the whole landscape, really, if there are too many of them.
So as ITA moves forward, and you're very clearly expanding throughout all of Idaho, what are some of your goals, or where do you hope to bring or move ITA into the future?
I think we started with this very clear focus on more trails need to be maintained and the land managers need help, and we want to help. And we want to help in a way that doesn't burden the land manager. You know, we've really strived to be a self-sufficient group where we coordinate with those land managers, come up with these project schedules with, you know, 10 projects on the Sawtooth National Forest. And yes, we're definitely trying to expand over into Eastern Idaho. We've done, I think last year we might have done 4 projects in Eastern Idaho, a couple on the Caribou-Targhee National Forest, a couple on city land, I believe, maybe one. It might have been BLM leading to city, but the whole idea is that we can mobilize, show up with our tools, we're trained, we have our safety gear, and we can just do the work without asking the Forest Service or the other land managers to support us in, you know, by having to send out someone to supervise us, for example. But I think over time, we've realized that that's still a primary goal for us. We want to maintain and clear as many miles of trail every summer as possible to benefit the public and make these trails accessible and help with that maintenance backlog. But the less tangible benefits are just really apparent when, I mean, the reason I'm working for ITA is because, I guess, you know, fortuitously, my high school age at the time son was signed up for an ITA youth project, one of the first ones ITA hosted back in 2019, I think. And a friend of mine was supposed to lead the trip, ended up with a schedule conflict, couldn't go, said, hey, you've done trail work. Can you go help lead this trip? And I was out there with 10 teenagers in the Frank Church Wilderness and 2 other crew leaders for a week. And I came back and I thought, man, we need to do more of this. I mean, we got some great trail work done, but the kids, you know, these 14, 15-year-old boys and girls, some from rural Council Idaho area and some from Boise, you know, initially that first day they're like sizing each other up. You know, there wasn't a lot of conversation and it's like, oh, we're the country kids, we're the city kids. And by the end of that week, not a phone had been seen. You know, it was pre-TikTok, but whatever kids were doing on their phones then, you know, texting and Snapchat, and no one had mentioned missing their phones, technology. They were playing campfire games and working as a team on the trail. And even the kids who had never really camped before were entirely comfortable by the end of that week, like setting up their tent and hiking and preparing their day pack. And just seeing that connection amongst these kids who initially thought they had nothing in common and seeing how fast it happened, like it's just accelerated, I think, this connection between people when they get out there and they have this common goal and everyone's doing something that's, you know, pretty new to them. Like a lot of them had been hiking before, but none of them had worked on a trail and used these tools like a crosscut saw where you have to work as a team. I mean, our mission statement is keeping Idaho's hiking trails open for all, but kind of the subtext of that now is like, by doing this, we're bringing people together who are finding this common ground in time when sometimes if you look at your phone, you think, man, nobody gets along anymore. They're finding this connection with nature. They're kind of, you're able to get away from technology, leave with this sense of physical and mental accomplishment, I think. And so we've really branched out into like the educational aspect of trail work. We have a backpacking 101 trip, a couple trips every summer now focused on teaching the basic skills of backpacking with doing a little bit of trail work. But the primary focus of that project isn't trail work. It's learning about backpacking and hoping we can introduce more people to that. Whereas maybe they were a little afraid to try it before. We have a grant program for helping people purchase gear if they want to take that next step and start backpacking or hiking who haven't done it before. So we're really also focused now on trying to connect people with land and with each other through this trail work and provide some educational opportunities in addition to just being about, you know, getting those miles of trail cleared.
That's wonderful. I love the idea of disconnecting to reconnect to nature, right? And, you know, at any age, trails sort of, maybe because the cell service is not so good, it kind of forces you to just enjoy being off the gizmos and reconnecting. And the trails is the conduit by which you do it. And so it's fantastic work that you're doing. So Idaho is a gigantic state. And we'll get to the trivia question in a second. But are there parts of the state that your organization sees a special need?
There are. And I think, you know, we're so fortunate to have so many acres of designated wilderness in Idaho. It, you know, really gives someone the chance to find somewhere truly remote, to seek solitude, to seek adventure, to explore. But the challenge logistically is both kind of a function, I think, of the topography of Idaho. You know, everything's, well, half the state is like steep. It's a river or it's the top of a peak. And the distance between is the 45% slope. and so it's a challenge getting to those areas. And it's also just a function of how big these wilderness areas are. So if you take the Central Idaho Wilderness Complex, the Frank Church and the Selway Bitterroot and the Gospel Hump Wilderness areas, those areas, they're just so hard to get to that trail maintenance is just inherently difficult. And so we find that there's a huge need there. And we spend a lot of time maintaining trails in wilderness areas. You might take a whole day to hike into an area. We might jet boat up a river. We might end up flying to a backcountry airstrip. Oftentimes we have pack stock, like mule trains that haul our gear in, but it's oftentimes a whole day just to get where you're going. And then we'll spend anywhere from 2 to, I guess the last 2 years, we've done 3 week long wilderness immersion projects where crews spend, you know, 14, 15, 16 days working on a trail. And then there's that whole day to get out and oftentimes a whole day to drive home. Our volunteers are incredible. I mean, whether they dedicate a day or 3 weeks to this, getting to the trails and those wilderness areas is a real challenge. And it takes a lot of people and a lot of planning to sometimes get, you know, 5 or 6 miles of trail cleared where there are thousands of miles in those areas. So there's a need all over the state, but I would say those wilderness areas is where we really feel like there's a constant need. I mean, then you have a wildfire, a flood, or, you know, just a big snow year. And sometimes you're kind of, I don't want to say back to square one. It feels like we're always making progress. So is the Forest Service, the BLM. But there are years when you're like, oh, man, here we go. You know, we just worked on that trail and there was a huge windstorm. And
right.
It's well, a constant need.
To get back to our trivia question then and the scale of the problem, roughly how many miles of non-motorized trails are in Idaho?
Roughly 10,000. And it was hard during our conversation. I really wanted to throw that out there. You know, we use that statistic a lot. Idaho is huge, but that's a lot of trail. And that it's a rough number. And there was a University of Idaho study that actually came out. I want to say it's probably been 8 years. And so I'm not actually certain how much things have changed percentage wise. But the statistic that that study cited was that roughly 30% of those 10,000 miles were maintained to standard. So brush cut back, logs cleared off, the trail tread taken care of. And I don't think it's changed a lot, probably. There are a lot of great groups, the Forest Service, other nonprofits, all working towards maintaining more of those 10,000 miles. But it's kind of a two steps forward, one step back approach sometimes with, you mean, just the nature of the work. So yeah, 10,000 miles.
Thank you so much, Melanie, for joining us today and talking about trails. And for our listeners, that means there's approximately 7,000 miles of trails that still need some type of work and maintenance done to them. If you're interested about our trail system or if you want to help, please go to IdahoTrailsAssociation.org and see what they do and maybe volunteer or join a crew and help with our trails. Thank you, Melanie.
Yep, we'd love to have you. If you've never hiked, never done trail work, not a problem. It's fun. Come join us.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU-FM. Shows are produced at KISU Studios in Pocatello at Idaho State University with editing and production by Mackenzie Young. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org or from Spotify and other select podcast services. Send your thoughts and suggestions to noid-kisu@isu.edu.